You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me on the Breakfast Grill today is Professor Barry Eichengreen. He is the George C. Pardee and Helen N. Pardee Professor of Economics and Political Science at the University of California, Berkeley in the USA. He was awarded the Economic History Association's Jonathan R. T. Hughes Prize for Excellence in Teaching in 2002, has been a recipient of the Schumpeter Prize, and Professor Eichengreen was also named one of Foreign Policy Magazine's 100 Leading Global Thinkers in 2011. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. The President of the United States, Donald Trump, has been hogging the media headlines and television for months now since his victory. I want to begin with the debacle that he's had in Congress, and that has been his inability to pass the replacement of the repeal and then a replacement for the Affordable Care Act. Could you just explain to a Malaysian audience what this really means? I mean, what exactly are the consequences of this reversal in the legislative agenda of the Trump administration?
I think what's been revealed is that President Trump is not really a master of the details of healthcare reform. Healthcare reform is complicated, it's hard, and the president basically outsourced the process to the Congress, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Paul Ryan. And Mr. Ryan had not done his homework in the same way that Mr. Trump had not done his homework. So I think one implication is that people in the White House have learned that healthcare reform is hard. They're about to learn that corporate tax reform is hard. They're about to learn that personal income tax reform is hard. And they're about to learn that getting a consensus on a $1 trillion infrastructure spending initiative is hard as well. So I think all of this is a signal that moving the president's economic policy agenda forward will be much more difficult than he himself and his circle anticipated.
So why the lack of preparation for the difficulties of dealing with the legislative process? Is it naivete? It's been said by critics and observers that Trump is not ideological, and yet he has tethered himself to a very ideological party. At this point in time, the Republicans apparently are very ideological. Help us understand that. I mean, first of all, is Trump ideological?
I don't think Trump is ideological, except in the sense of channeling some traditional American political values that stretch all the way back to other populist presidents like Andrew Jackson in the first half of the 19th century, who ran on an America First platform, who ran on a Common Man First platform. The Republican Party is deeply ideological, libertarian, small government, and that is not necessarily Mr. Trump. That conflict is one of the reasons, I think, why his collaboration with people like Paul Ryan has not been smooth. The simple lack of preparation is part of the story, that it's easier to be an outsider and be a candidate to run against the system than it is to actually make a policy agenda move forward.
In fact, I believe Paul Ryan, in sort of addressing the failures of pushing the bill through, spoke about the Republicans being out of power for two terms now and being a party of no, and now they have to be a party of yes, as it were. For me, that seemed quite curious. I mean, the Republicans have been part of American government for a long time now. And so in being out of government, you'd think that they would be prepared for the day when they would, in fact, take over.
Obamacare is a good example, I think, of the broader problem. If a president of the other party occupies the White House, you can pass a symbolic repeal bill in the Congress. The president will veto it. You've made your political statement without any real-world consequences. Now that the Republicans are in power, repeal is not enough. They have to repeal and replace, and What we learned is that they don't have a plan of how to replace. They have an ideology that is antagonistic to the idea that government should be involved in the provision of health care. But we live in a world where healthcare markets, privately organized, don't work that well, and government plays a role in the provision of healthcare in virtually every country on the face of the earth. So that is a real dilemma for the Republican Party now. If your ideology says get government out of the business of providing healthcare, but the fact of the matter is that purely private healthcare markets do not work, there is no replace in the repeal and replace equation consistent with Republican Party ideology. The Republican Party will have to now evolve and change course, but that kind of change does not occur overnight.
Now, one of the things that's also happened is that Donald Trump, after a period of blaming the Democrats for the failure to push this bill through, said that he would reach out to Democrats. I understand that American parties, especially the mainstream Republican Democrat Party, big tent parties. I think that's the expression that's used. And so you have these factions and you have the moderate Republicans versus the Freedom House Caucus. How does that play out in terms of getting some sort of coherent policies out for the American people during this Trump administration?
You need middle of the road policies. So in the present instance, there's talk about how it would be possible to proceed with an infrastructure spending initiative, and Democrats ought to be positively inclined to renewing the country's infrastructure and marrying that corporate and income tax reform that will provide the country with a more efficient tax system. The problem is that the income and corporate tax reforms that the Republicans have put on the table are very regressive. They benefit the wealthy disproportionately. It's not too strong to say they benefit the wealthy only. So I don't think the Democrats will come to the table with that kind of compromise. I think they would be willing to support a combination of tax reform and infrastructure spending only if it was a more moderate, working class friendly form of tax reform.
Can I ask you very, very quickly, I mean, just not to digress from the main discussion, which is the idea that it was, in some sense, the Rust Belt, the working class that that elected Donald Trump, but a man who, in some ways, doesn't represent their class interests. Why is the American working class voting against its own self-interest?
Probably because the American working class didn't entirely understand what it was voting for. That Trump promised them that his policies would be good for the working class, they would be good for manufacturing workers. And what they're beginning to see now is that he's appointing a lot of advisors and cabinet members from Goldman Sachs. He's outsourcing tax reform to congressional leaders who have traditionally favored and continue to favor the wealthy. So either Trump is going to have to move away from those interests and remain loyal to his working class voters, or he's going to alienate those working class voters. As we speak, his approval ratings have sunk into the 30%, somewhere between 30 and 40%. He can't stay there. He's going to have to move in one or the other direction.
One of the other things that has been in the limelight has been the judicial confirmation process of Neil Gorsuch. Could you tell us why it is? I mean, what I understand is, especially with the Christian conservative community, that they voted for Trump because they believed it was necessary in the run-up of this vacancy in the Supreme Court, and the expectation that some justices of the Supreme Court will also retire because of their age, that there's a way of stacking the bench with conservative members, conservative judges who can push a conservative, perhaps Christian agenda. Would that be an adequate characterization of the politics around this judicial confirmation process?
I think it's an adequate description of part of what is going on. So, yes, it is true that Trump's support came disproportionately from what we refer to in the United States as evangelicals, Christian voters who have a fundamental view of what religion, what Christianity entails. Trump promised them a Supreme Court justice or justices who interpreted the Constitution in a very traditional form, in a manner consistent with what the writers of the Constitution might have had in mind 200 years ago, and now he's trying to deliver on that process. Finding Judge Gorsuch was easier than doing healthcare reform or tax reform, so he could find a like-minded judge and nominate him. That's part of what's going on.
Has American politics become so divisive that, in fact, it's impossible to move? Is there gridlock at every turn for any administration going forward, including Donald Trump? I understand he controls Congress now, but even that hasn't proved particularly valuable for him, at least in the case of the Affordable Care Act. What's happened to American politics, I mean, essentially?
I think American politics have unquestionably become more polarized, that the division between the parties is greater than it has been in the past, with the Republicans by and large moving in a more conservative direction with the so-called Freedom Caucus, the Democrats moving by and large in a more social democratic, we call it in the U.S. liberal direction, because congressional district lines have been redrawn in ways that they're either safe for Democrats or safe for Republicans, and there's no incentive for candidates of either party to move to the center. Having said that, there are also significant divisions within the parties. So the problem Trump had with health care reform is he had to make the reform bill increasingly conservative and mean to the working class to keep the conservative members of the Republican Party on board. And the more he did that, the more he alienated and lost the more centrist members of the Republican Party. All that means, in my view, is that it will continue to be very difficult to move an economic policy agenda forward. And the president will be inclined, therefore, to do what he can do unilaterally without congressional consent, which means trade policy, where he has considerable powers on his own, and foreign policy.
I'm speaking to Professor Barry Eichengreen, a professor of economics and political science at the University of California, Berkeley in the USA. Next up, we look at the animal spirits that have been unleashed, as well as America's international commitments in trade and the environment. BFM 89.9. I'm speaking to Professor Barry Eichengreen, professor of economics and political science at the University of California, Berkeley. We've been talking about the United States, a disruptor in chief, some call him, President Donald Trump and his agenda. We didn't have time earlier to speak about the White House, and in particular the role of Donald Trump's son-in-law and daughter in the administration. Perhaps people, in the third world would be much more familiar with this kind of family relationships in politics. Very quickly, before we get into the question of economics and international commitments, Americans upset that his daughter should have a place in the White House and given access to confidential information? Is this something that goes against the grain in American politics?
I think Americans are somewhere between bemused, confused, and upset. It's certainly the case that family members have been involved in politics over time. Eleanor Roosevelt was an important advisor to FDR. Bobby Kennedy was attorney general under John F. Kennedy. So it's not entirely unprecedented, but the extent of reliance on family to the exclusion of almost all other advisors is something we've never seen before, especially when those other family members still have important business interests. So you will recall the 1990s, the Asian financial crisis, when U.S. policymakers came to Asia, they came to Indonesia, they came to Malaysia, and they criticized these family connections and talked about so-called crony capitalism. Well, now the tables turn.
What do you think is going on in Donald Trump's mind? Is the president convinced that this is necessary for the success of his administration? Does he not trust other people? Is it an issue of trust?
I think it's an issue of trust. I think it's an issue of lack of familiarity with how government works and that there are career civil servants and others with a lot of knowledge of where the key to the closet is that you need to rely on and utilize in order to have an effective administration. But your basic point is correct that Trump and some of his advisors like Steve Bannon talk about a deep state or a shadow government that the people who would normally be advising on policy, writing policy papers, analyzing the incoming data flow are, in Trump's mind, the enemy. And therefore, he relies disproportionately on the small number of people, generally with the same last name as his, who he feels he can trust.
You use the expression deep state, and it's a curious one. It tends, I think, been sort of on the margins of discourse, often attributed to conspiracy theorists, as well as people, you know, maybe on the sort of Marxist end of the spectrum in terms of analyzing social phenomena. Why has the deep state, and has the deep state as a phenomena, a recognizable phenomena, become mainstream? And people say, yes, this is true. America does have a deep state, a state within a state, as it were.
I think to call it mainstream would be to go too far. It's a phrase that has been bandied around, that's gained a lot of currency in the last few weeks. I think it comes from a small handful of people like Steve Bannon, who have adhered to those views for quite a while. And it's a most extraordinary situation at the moment that they now have the ear of the president. But more broadly, this applies to foreign policy, economic policy, and everything else. I do think there is something of a battle for the soul of the president going on, where there are people on the extreme right. They're so far out on the extreme right, they are where the extreme right meets or resembles the extreme left. In contrast, there are moderates, mainstream economists, and political advisors, and the two factions are battling for the soul, battling for the ear of the president. I can't think of anything analogous in my lifetime.
On a positive note, as it were, the markets have been reflecting serious bullish sentiment. People talk about animal spirits, as Keynes would, having been unleashed. And there's been a great expectation of deregulation and such that's excited the markets. Do you see this as misplaced? Or can the markets, in fact, having now bet on Trump when they previously hadn't, actually make some gains during this administration?
The markets have made some gains, but I think in reacting the way they did, they have overreacted. We know that this is what markets do. They overreact to surprises like Trump's election. There is some reason to think that deregulation will be good for business profits. Deregulation of the financial sector will be good for the profits of financial institutions. And those are the stocks that have responded positively in the main. But what's good for profits is not necessarily good for the economy, good for people, good for economic growth. And that distinction is now beginning to sink in. The markets had been betting on not only deregulation, but healthcare reform, corporate tax reform, individual income tax reform, a big infrastructure spending initiative. They're now evidently beginning to question, beginning to doubt whether those other things are going to take place.
Do you see a coherence between Donald Trump's desire for jobs growth, his anti-trade position, and then his concerns about a strong dollar? How do all those three things come together in his mind, do you think, in terms of, and does it make for coherent policy?
I think you're likely imputing too much coherence to the president's mind, that he would like a weak dollar because the U.S. would be able to export more. That would be good for American manufacturing. That would help to bring, quote, good manufacturing jobs, unquote, back to the United States. But every single other thing that he is doing makes for a strong dollar. The infrastructure spending initiative, the bigger budget deficits in the face of higher interest rates, the import tariffs, the shift to a different corporate tax regime, the so-called border adjustment tax. All of those are going to be strengthening the dollar where Trump wants a weaker dollar. So there is a fundamental tension, incompatibility, incoherence between the policies and the desired objective. So how does that play out in the end? I think the president would like a weaker, more competitive dollar. What he's doing will deliver a stronger dollar, which will make him unhappy. What will he do? He will look for the villain of the piece. One possible villain is the Fed, which is raising interest rates and strengthening the dollar. Another possible villain is foreign central banks and governments, which are on the other side of the exchange rate equation and likely to be accused by the United States of manipulating their currencies, ironically, given the fact that it's America's own policies that will have been pushing up the dollar, not foreign central bank policies.
Donald Trump has many fans in emerging markets. Do you think their faith in Donald Trump is misplaced? What do you think is going on with many of his foreign admirers?
I'm a little bit surprised, but would be interested to hear more about those foreign admirers. What they should look out for is the fact that Trump really takes seriously his America First rhetoric. So he cares about America. He doesn't care one bit about other countries or their residents. So, you know, over time, the U.S. has done selfless things like the Marshall Plan, like stationing troops in foreign hotspots like South Korea to try to keep the peace. I think Mr. Trump is not interested in such matters. He's interested in what makes America richer. When Angela Merkel came to Washington, he apparently literally presented her with a bill which was a piece of paper, which gave her Mr. Trump's estimate of how much money Germany owed NATO. So a lot of other emerging markets are going to be presented with analogous bills, I think, in one form or another, and they should prepare themselves.
I believe the White House denied that. But finally, Professor, I want to ask you if you think this will be a presidency of consequence, and do you think Donald Trump will succeed, however modestly, in changing the course of American politics?
I think Trump can change the course of American politics through his appointment. So the Supreme Court was one example, which you've already given. Another one would be the Federal Reserve Board, the Board of Governors, where people are appointed for terms of 14 years. There are currently two openings. Next month there will be three. Next year there will be five. So you can permanently change the course of Supreme Court judgments or Federal Reserve policy through appointments. Will he be able to do more for all the reasons we've been talking about, his own temperament, the nature of the Congress, I have my doubts. But we would have to have a much longer discussion of the definition of success. Will he be successful? It depends on what you mean by success. And it's worth bearing in mind we're still in the very early days.
Thank you very much. I've been speaking to Professor Barry Eichengreen, Professor of Economics and Political Science at the University of California, Berkeley, in the United States. And you've been listening to The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.